listeners. Welcome to Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast dedicated to Central and Eastern Europe and the official podcast of the New Eastern Europe magazine. My name is Agnieszka Widłaszewska, and with me is one of our other co-hosts, Maciek Makulski. Hello, Maciek.
Hello, Aga. Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode. It is the last episode in July, actually, and the last one before our short summer break. So we will listen to each other again in September.
Indeed. But hopefully you won't miss us too much. Hopefully you can always catch up on our other episodes. Our patrons can also expect some additional content coming their way during this break. So
despite the break, our patrons will get some extra podcasts. So please check out your patron email boxes in August too. And today I wrote a short post on our close Facebook group about the special content. So check it out if you have time. And we will be also in touch with you also through Patreon website. And if you are not our patron yet, please consider supporting us in this way. Make sure to listen to the end of this episode to learn more about the benefits for patrons. And today we are looking again at Georgia. Aga, you have been working on this episode, so maybe you could introduce the topic and our guest.
Sure. I think we have been planning this episode for quite some time now. As our regular listeners will know, we have dedicated quite a bit of attention to the European Council that took place in June, during which Ukraine and the Republic of Moldova were given EU candidate status, whilst Georgia, which also applied for EU membership, was given a European perspective, but not yet this candidate status. And this was, of course, quite a tricky development for Georgia as a country and for the Georgian population, which came out in big protests against this development, but sort of partially against the way the Georgian government is leading the country, not so much against the EU, because the Georgian population is largely in favor of the EU and the Euro-Atlantic integration. So we thought that it would be important to talk about this, because indeed it's a tricky situation. And we had a very interesting guest for this episode. I sat down with Grigol Djuluhidze, who is a director and senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Council, which is an independent think tank based in Tbilisi. And Grigol has really quite a lot of insights into internal Georgian politics, but also sort of the situation in the region overall. He used to be an analyst of Visegrad Group at the Parliament of Poland. He was a visiting scholar at the Slovak Foreign Policy Association. And nowadays he also works as a lecturer of security studies at different Georgian and European universities. So we had a really, really great chat, I think. And also fun fact about Grigol, he speaks impeccable Polish. And by that, I mean, if I just heard him speak and I didn't see him, didn't see his surname, I didn't know anything about him, I would be dead sure that he's Polish. And apparently he doesn't even have any Polish origins. He just learned it. So kudos to Grigol, because it was truly impressive. And he puts me to shame because I don't speak a word of Georgian. And as he pointed out, that also means that I cannot grasp the sheer chaos of Georgian politics and what Georgian politicians say to one another. So I think this is a double motivation, if you will, for me to maybe learn a bit of Georgian, to be able to speak Grigol's language with him, and to perhaps follow Georgian politics a bit more closely.
Fingers crossed for you, Aga, and learning process of Georgian. I think I'm not that brave, but that's truly impressive that he speaks Polish that well.
Yes, absolutely. It was really, really great to speak a bit of Polish with him. But of course, don't worry, the interview is in English, so you can all follow. And just one more sort of piece of information from me, because Grigol mentioned in the beginning of our interview the Charles Michel agreement that was brokered by the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, in April 2021. And just as an additional word of introduction on that agreement, in case our listeners don't remember. So this agreement was basically aiming at terminating this deadlock that was in place between the Georgian government and the opposition. And it was aiming also at bringing opposition MPs back to the parliament after a months-long boycott. And it included some provisions on releasing jailed opposition figures and introducing further electoral and judicial reforms. But in the end, at first it was hailed as a great success, especially of EU diplomacy and Charles Michel specifically. But then eventually the ruling Georgian Dream Party withdrew from this agreement at the end of July. And this sort of brought back the whole political crisis, which Grigol has talked a lot about during the interview. But also, if you would like to go back to that period and hear more information about this whole process, we did talk about it in our episode number 78. I went back to my little Excel sheet to double check this. And it was, we published it in September last year. So this was episode 78, in which Adam interviewed Josip Dzamkashvili. And they had a very interesting chat about all these developments. So do check it out if you're interested.
Data is everything. Thank you, Agnieszka. You have this Excel still and you develop it further. Yeah, I remember, I think in all our previous episodes on Georgia, we used to say that it's, you know, we are observing a hot, dynamic situation, internal situation in Georgia. But I think it's something like a just normal thing for Georgia's politics. Yeah, like there is no actually break or boredom in domestic situation in Georgia, which is also quite telling. Aga, thank you very much for this informative introduction. And maybe with this, we can now listen to your interview with Grigol Dzhulhidze.
And welcome back to Talk Eastern Europe. This is Aga speaking, and with me is our guest for this week's episode, Grigol Dzhulhidze. Grigol, welcome to Talk Eastern Europe.
Thank you very much for having me.
We are very happy to have you. This has been a long time coming because, of course, Georgia has been on our minds for a long time, but especially in the past weeks following the European Council in June, during which Ukraine and Moldova were granted EU candidate status, while Georgia was given a European perspective and a potential future candidate status once it fulfills a number of requirements. And of course, that was quite a significant development in terms of the enlargement policy and neighborhood policy of the EU. But for Georgia specifically, of course, it's a bittersweet moment for sure. And it sort of comes also as there are increasing tensions within Georgia between the pro-European population, or a large part of the population that is pro-European, pro-EU, and the government, which seems to have a more ambiguous stance, if you will, on this European integration. So I'm very happy to have you here so that we can discuss a bit more in detail what has led to this decision by the European Council not to grant Georgia this EU candidate status, and what we can expect in the future. And also, hopefully, we can talk a little bit more about Georgia specifically and what's happening in the country at this point. So I wanted to start with a general question regarding this decision of the European Council. Why was Georgia left behind in that sense? Why was it not granted this EU candidate status? And what kind of conditions has the European Commission presented in its opinion on Georgia's membership application?
Well, the main reason is the worsened relations between Tbilisi and Brussels. I mean, the Georgian government and the whole political elite violated the Charles Michel agreement, which had been signed in April 2020, and it was oriented mainly on the, let's say, depolarization of political situation in Georgia, because we have a huge political crisis in the country. When the government does not speak with the opposition, the other way around. Also, it should be noted that the position of the ruling party of Georgia, I mean, the Georgian Dream, let's say, coalition, was very weak in terms of the war in Ukraine. I mean, the Georgian society, more than 85% of the whole population, supports Ukraine and openly declares that that this is our war, and let's say the public order towards the government was much more courageous, much braver steps towards the support of Ukraine. But the position of the government was, for many Georgians, disappointing. I mean, they made very weak statements and declarations in support of Ukraine, where they have not mentioned anything about Russia. Also, due to the fact that there are some doubts about the direct contacts of Bidzina Ivanishvili, who is the founder of the Georgian Dream Party, which currently officially is not involved in Georgian politics, but there are some concerns about the informal governance from his part, has direct contacts with the Kremlin-affiliated related businessmen and the Kremlin. And these are the main reasons why such kind of decision was made. Apart from it, main remark from the European Commission in its recommendation paper was the politically motivated persecution of politicians. I mean, we talk about the former president of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili, who is imprisoned. We talk about the director of the opposition TV station, the main channel opposition TV station, Nika Gvaramia. And the majority of these issues played a key role in the decision that was made by the European Commission, I mean, the negative decision. But at the same time, we have to admit that it is a decision which may lead to the increase of Russian influences here. And of course, I'm pretty sure we'll be talking about this topic as well. But institutionally and from the technical point of view, Georgia has much better indexes and positions than Ukraine and Moldova. But decision was political due to, first of all, a political crisis and the weak position of Georgian government in terms of the war in Ukraine, and a very, let's say, weak statements about the Russian aggression, which by many pro-governmental experts is evaluated as a rational part of the rational policy. But at the same time, there are, as I have already mentioned, huge disappointment in the society that the government should have done more than it did from the political perspective. So these are the main reasons from my personal point of view why Georgia did not get this candidate status from the European Union.
I absolutely agree with you that basically this a lot of these decisions are to a large extent political, and it's very interesting to see how, depending on the moment in time, the political setup in different countries, some of them might progress in terms of the European integration much faster all of a sudden after, let's say, years and years of, for example, relative lack of progress and lack of development. And here for sure, it has played a role. But what is also interesting for me from the Georgian perspective, so like you said, well, the Georgian government has had a pretty dubious record in recent years, but still they decided to apply for this EU membership. So they just maybe give our listeners a bit of a context. First, Ukraine applied on the 28th of February, so just a few days after the start of the Russian invasion. And then the Republic of Moldova and Georgia applied together, well, on the same day, on 3rd of March, so just a few days later. And so I was wondering here, what would be the motivation of the government to apply for EU membership, even though they don't seem genuinely interested in it at this point?
Well, they are interested in this point, I can be sure. But this is the case when you want to lose weight but do not want to go to the gym. So it is such kind of situation. Yes, the ruling elite would be very happy to get this candidate status. But at the same time, they had the wrong perception of the European Union in terms of the requirements that this institution has. Sometimes they think that it is quite easy to get something from the European Union, which is wrong. And at the same time, it was a very good momentum, political momentum for this application. And it was right, absolutely. It was a very rational decision. And apart from it, let's look at the population of Georgia. More than 80% of the country supports Georgia's Euro-Atlantic aspirations. And this decision and this application was in direct line with the will of the majority of Georgians. But of course, the expectations were different, and the reality is absolutely, let's say, different from these expectations. So it was a right decision in a right moment. It was in the interest of the government to apply for this candidate status, but they did actually nothing for getting a positive response. And this is the, once again, I repeat this word, this is the responsibility of the whole political elite. Because I remember once this decision was, recommendations were published by the European Commission, more than 130,000 Georgians gathered in Tbilisi, which is a record number for a tiny country like Georgia is. And there was no politician on the stage. Do you know why? Because there is a huge political crisis, and the appearance of even one Georgian politician from the opposition, from the position, doesn't matter, would lead to the decrease of the number of demonstrants. And it was an emotional response of Georgians to the decision of the European Commission, recommendations of the European Commission, but it was not the act of support towards one political party or another. It was not a protest either towards the government. Because, as I have already mentioned, it was a decision of the, I mean, emotional feedback of all Georgians to go to the streets and say that we Georgians are Europeans.
Yes, it's interesting what you mentioned about this polarization and how essentially it's not very much welcomed when you have political figures appearing in protests, because I noticed that as well in Poland at some point. We've obviously seen our fair share of protests in recent years, and it also was noticeable at some point that politicians themselves and organizers of the protests were trying to avoid any political statements or clear political affiliation of these protests, because otherwise it would have become less popular.
Yes, but Aga, the political polarization of Poland and Georgia even cannot be compared to each other.
No, of course no, but it was, yeah.
It is like we are in jungle from this point of view in Georgia. So you don't speak Georgian and you don't know on what kind of topics the discussions are going on here. So it is once again, it illustrates how sometimes irrational Georgian political elite is.
Well, I'll definitely have to consider learning Georgian then to try and understand, to grasp the whole scale of what's happening there. But no, yeah, this is just to say that indeed there's this element to protesting in countries with polarized political scene. But it's also interesting, so you mentioned this very high support for the Euro-Atlantic aspirations. And I was wondering, indeed, when we see these mass protests, it seems that they are very visible, and it seems that there's such a big part of the Georgian population that is pro-European and pro-Euro-Atlantic integration. But at the same time, there is a big part of the population that is supporting Georgian Dream as a ruling party for many years now. And of course, here, I was wondering what kind of profile is, what is the electorate essentially of the Georgian Dream, and how do they play into this support for the Euro-Atlantic integration? So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about who are the people voting for the Georgian Dream, and are they more Eurosceptic than the opposition electorate, or is the European integration not really a priority for them, or do they actually think that Georgian Dream is more pro-European, pro-EU than it actually is? And maybe they don't notice so much that in terms of reforms, Georgia is not progressing so much, and they still think that they are on the right track in a way.
Well, in my opinion, the main part of the supporters of the Georgian Dream Party is the part of the population which hates the opposition. I mean, the main reason why the Georgian Dream is still in power is the fact that there is a huge political crisis, and under these circumstances, there are no serious political opponents in the country. And when the ruling party, with a huge administrative resources, financial resources, at the same time, people who are the employees or people who are employed in state agencies and let's say in different ministries or municipalities are natural supporters of the government traditionally in the countries like Georgia happens. We have such kind of, let's say, tradition in commerce. And the main reason for the success, electoral success of the Georgian Dream are the above mentioned factors, which is the administrative resource, much bigger financial capacities than opposition has, a huge political crisis owing to which there are no serious opponents, and Georgia is a country which needs political leaders, because there are some nations which do not need some charismatic leaders who will lead the people to the victory, to the triumph, to the change. In case of Georgia, all the most important political transformations and changes happened thanks to the direct involvement of a charismatic leader. When Georgia regained its independence in the 90s, it was Riad Gamsakhurdia, then it was Eduard Shevardnadze, then comes Rose Revolution with Mikhail Saakashvili, then was the change of the government with billionaire Bidzina Ivanishvili, who had a very good image at that time. But right now, there is a huge deficit. There is absolutely and literally nobody who would become the face of the opposition. And the majority of Georgians right now are very tired due to the poor financial and economic conditions, growing migration. A lot of Georgians flee the country, leave their hometowns and villages and cities due to the very low income, and they find jobs in the West. And all this, the combination of all these things really create the political reality of Georgia, in which a Georgian Dream is a ruling party still. And as for the answer to your question, it is very hard to concretely define who is the part of the society, which part of the society votes for this party. It is very hard to say, because all of them, actually, those who hate opposition, administrative resource, plus people who are just directly paid by the ruling party related entities, the bribes, and this serious problem of the Georgian political life since the regaining the independence. And all this combination create the current reality, political reality. And I have the impression that nobody thinks while make the electoral decision, I mean, in the majority of cases, which party is pro-Western and which is not. Because the main thing that matters in Georgian politics and in Georgia is emotion. Emotionally, how certain situation will be evaluated, and upon to the concrete situation, the decision will be made. So it is the mix of these mentioned components that define the political reality and the electoral success of Georgian Dream.
That's really interesting. So essentially what I'm getting from this is that we can't even say for sure whether the people voting for the Georgian Dream are pro-EU or against EU. There might be actually a lot of Georgian Dream voters who in principle are pro-EU and pro-European integration, right? But they sort of
At the same time, yes, everything is possible because look at the demonstration. We talked about the mass demonstration of June 20, and this demonstration gathered thousands of supporters of Georgian Dream Party as well, because the idea of the Western and European future of Georgia is very attractive for Georgians. More than 80% supports this political orientation. But it is a very hard picture to understand because a lot of Western experts evaluated this demonstration as a protest towards the government. But when the next two mass demonstrations were organized, the number of people was less and less. Do you know why? Because the direct narrative and message of these demonstrations were a resignation of the government. So one of the main reasons of the decreased number of demonstrants was the fact that not all of the gathered demonstrants from June 20 supported the idea of, let's say, elections or the resignation of the Georgian Dream Party.
Right, yeah. And here I'm also wondering because... So I understand now that essentially this support for the Georgian Dream might not necessarily be strictly linked to the party itself and its platform and its policies, but it's more due to the general situation in the country. But of course, now with the war, and like you said, Georgia has not, or the Georgian government has not responded in a particularly forceful way, while at the same time, of course, Georgia has had a very sort of serious and traumatic experience itself with Russia and Russian territorial expansions. So I'm wondering here, is this not going to impact the support it enjoys among, let's say, this part of the population that happened to vote for it for one reason to another? But would that not be a red line for a lot of people, that the fact that the Georgian government has not responded forcefully enough means that we should stop supporting them?
Well, I don't think that the majority of the supporters of the Georgian Dream Party are pro-Europeans. It is not always the case. It logically may not be right. So before every election, the reality is different in Georgia. But one thing is absolutely common before every election: extreme polarization. If you do not vote for us, these murderers from the opposition will be back and arrest you, and they will start various punitive actions, and they will punish you due to your support to Georgian Dream. And this propaganda works. That's why people the majority of people in Georgia do not think about the pro-European orientation or pro-Georgian orientation, which is a very favorite narrative of the Russian propaganda here. Well, the problem is that emotions matter in Georgia. Due to this aspect and norm of the Georgian politics, people do not react to, for example, to corruption scandal, to, let's say, the worsened economic or financial situation, increased prices, as Western societies do. But if you touch some emotional topic, people will come out and protest. And I remind you the elections of 2012, when about 60% of Georgians supported Georgian Dream Party because they showed the footage about the, let's say, rape in prisons, how prisoners, inmates were raped by policemen and were tortured. And this issue touched Georgians emotionally very much, and they changed the government. But since then on, the situation has not been changed really much because people are very, passive in terms of the protest toward the increased prices, worsened economic situation, serious challenge in terms of the increased challenges in terms of national security, and very weak actions of the government in this direction. People do not react. The nihilism is the main weapon that gives a hand to the government, plus useful idiots who are in the opposition. And at the same time, the I would say the wrong decision of the European parliament not to grant EU candidate status to Georgia because it gives a perfect opportunity to the Russian propaganda to manipulate public opinion in Georgia, because they are repeating over and over, do you see, guys, Georgians, Europeans do not want to. What else you should do in order to get this MAP, I mean, the membership action plan from the NATO? What else you should do in order to get the candidate status from the European Union? The truth is that you are not Europe, as they mention it, from Moscow. And I would say that this narrative works quite effectively. And if there are any fundamental challenges in here in Georgia, or at least in the positions of the European Union towards Georgia, this country becomes more and more vulnerable in terms of Russia's malware influence. So this combination works very, very effectively. This combination works very effectively and gives additional chance for Eurosceptic, which in reality mean pro-Russian forces in Georgia.
Right, yeah. So it's interesting to hear that they are still quite strong in terms of that the Russian propaganda can still hold sway in a way in Georgia, considering everything that has happened between Georgia and Russia over the years. But here I wanted to jump maybe a bit more into sort of very internal Georgian politics. And here I had questions specifically about two characters, if you will. One, you mentioned former President Mikhail Saakashvili, who is currently imprisoned. And when he came back to Georgia last year, it was quite an event, because he came back sort of knowing that he might be arrested and thrown to jail. And then there has been also a number of protests in relation to that, and he's been on hunger strike. Well, he was on hunger strike for a long time. And so I wanted to ask you if you could give us a little update on whether there's been anything new going on in this regard. And then the second question was about the current Georgian president Zurabishvili, who, as far as I remember, she ran as an independent candidate, but with the support of the Georgian Dream Party. But it seems to me, from what I've heard, there has been a growing rift between the president and the party. And so I was wondering what are the developments in this regard and what you've been noticing?
Well, if we talk about Saakashvili, I don't think that he's an active politician anymore, because he had very wrong calculations that he was still the most popular politician in Georgia, and that he would have been liberated by people if government would arrest him. Of course, that's the wrong calculation, because yes, he's a popular politician, but his popularity index is much lower than it was years ago. Yes, of course, that's his, let's say, merit, and it is the result of his very, very weird approach to Georgia, because he was very irrational in terms of Georgia. He was the governor of Odessa. He was making political statements about Georgia, and people had no idea he was where this politician was involved in Ukrainian or in Georgian political processes. Also, his stance was very weak, even in his own party, United Nations Movement. And the combination of these elements created very negative political background around him. He was he entered in Georgia in October. He was hoping for the appearance on the mass demonstration in Tbilisi, but he was arrested in the flat without any public reaction. And yes, there are still some protests among his supporters, but the number of people who support him and who want to save him from the prison is less and less. And I would say that his political career in Georgia from today's point of view is ended. And apart from it, he's a very weak conditions, and his health conditions affect his political future as well. So right now, for me, it's my personal opinion, the political career of Mikhail Saakashvili in Georgia is ended. and has very limited perspectives for the future. As for Salome Zurabishvili, yes, she became the president of Georgia thanks to the direct support of Bidzina Ivanishvili and Georgian Dream Party. But the dispute over the issue of Ukraine, because she wanted more and much braver support from Georgia towards Ukraine, while position of the government was very, let's say, neutral and sometimes very weak in terms of support to Ukraine, it became clear that their positions would confront to each other. And that's why the relationships between the government and Salome Zurabishvili are very tense, and most likely she will become one of the main opponents in the narrative of the Georgian dream, because as political reality shows, Salome Zurabishvili does not listen to the recommendations and demands of the government, but still tries not to be affiliated with the opposition. She's somewhere between the opposition and the government. But of course, her popularity index is very, very low, and I don't think that she will be able to run for presidential elections in the future as a candidate with great success. No.
Okay. That's interesting to learn. Let's see what happens with her political career, and let's see if Mikhail Saakashvili ever manages to, well, first get out of jail, and then if he can still come back somehow into the political life of Georgia. But maybe to wrap up a little bit our discussion here, and try to maybe look to the future a little bit, I was wondering, If we look at all of this that we've discussed, what might be the long game of the Georgian dream here? Because we've got all these different elements. We've got this ambiguous stance on the war, or lack of forceful response to the war, the potential ties to the Russian government, the influence of the Russian propaganda on the Georgian society. So how can all this affect Georgia in the long term? And can we, do you think that indeed it's going to go more in the direction of Russia gaining more and more influence? Or can we still expect the authorities to at least try and introduce some of these reforms that are required to progress on the EU accession path? Are they likely to perhaps become a bit more openly pro-European in order to convince the European Commission and the European Council to potentially grant Georgia candidate status in the future? What are your thoughts here?
Well, actually, I don't like to make predictions in the international relations, but the current reality shows that we have not expect any reforms from the government for getting this candidate status, because the political polarization and the political discourse today is oriented on different things. And of course, it will perfectly serve to Russian interests, directly or indirectly, because Georgia right now is very vulnerable, and Russia will involve much more elements here in Georgia to isolate this country from the West. And thanks to propaganda, disinformation machine, mass migration from Russia to Georgia, the different economic operations, this influence will be more and more. So at least in the next 6 months, we have not expect nothing apart from the growing influence of the Russian Federation in Georgia. So my prediction is very, let's say, pessimistic, but that's the reality that we see right now. So Russia will be gaining more and more influence here in Georgia, while the influence of the West will be less and less.
Right. Yeah, maybe indeed it's not a very optimistic one, but it's an important prediction and warning in a way. This is something that we should all pay attention to, and for sure civil society in Georgia should also pay attention to that, perhaps try as much as possible to fight against Russian disinformation, Russian propaganda. But this has been really, really interesting. Thank you so much, Grigol, for all these observations and opinions. I was wondering if there's anything, in case our listeners would like to find you, your work, what you do, is there anything that you would like to sort of promote or mention to our listeners?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me for this very interesting dialogue and conversation with you. I always follow your articles, the new Eastern Europe magazine, your podcast, and I always try to somehow keep this cooperation with your organization as a head of my organization, which is the Foreign Policy Council. We mainly focus on the influence of Russia in Georgia, how propaganda and disinformation is used in order to isolate Georgia from the West, and what kind of info operations is Moscow conducting here in Georgia and in the region. And I, as a researcher of the Russian propaganda, see this growing wave of disinformation narratives against the West, against the United States, against the United Kingdom, European Union, NATO, and Poland as well, which is a close ally of Georgia and an ardent supporter of territorial integrity and the Euro-Atlantic perspective. And, well, it is hard for me to say something about me, but from my daily work, I can say that the huge intensification of Facebook, Twitter, trolls and bots are noticed here in Georgia, and they work quite effectively, unfortunately. And their narrative mainly is dedicated to the demonization of the West and the demonization of the Western partners of Georgia and the whole democratic system and democratic world, which works quite effectively, especially in regions. And in the near future, we're going to publish a very interesting paper related and dedicated to this issue. And of course, we'll gladly share it with you and you as the monitors of the Georgia and the South Caucasus region. I'm pretty sure that it will be interesting even for you. So thank you very much, Aga, for inviting me. It was a pleasure, and hope to cooperate in the future as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much once again. And we will definitely put a link to the Foreign Policy Council's website in the description of this episode. And of course, if you have any new publications, we would be happy also to promote them. But for now, thank you so much, and see you later.
Thank you. See you later.
And that was Aga's interview with Grigol Dzhulukidze. For those who want to learn more about Georgia, I would recommend two recent articles on the New Eastern Europe website. One tackles Georgia's to-do list in order to be granted the EU candidate status and catch up with Ukraine and Moldova in this race. And the other one deals with the Russian emigration to Armenia and Georgia. Both articles are linked in the notes of this episode. So, Aga, thank you very much for conducting this interview. I think it was very interesting and important. It is important to us to stay updated on the developments in Georgia, because it is a very important country in the region. And especially now, when the EU is showcasing some new dynamic toward accession talks and integration with the close neighborhood, Georgia is, I think, an inherent element of this dynamic and our discussion. So do you have maybe any final reflections, conclusions after the interview you would like to share?
I think I just wanted to say that, first of all, I just really love talking to Grigol, and I feel like I had a list of questions to him, but he brought up so many additional points that I kept asking these follow-up questions, and I thought, oh gosh, I wish we could sit here for another hour so that we can talk about it, because he actually opened my eyes to some things that I wasn't exactly aware of. I think one of the very interesting things that he was saying is, you know, in a lot of countries, we can see quite a clear division in terms of political parties, that there are parties that are pro-European, parties that are Eurosceptic, parties that sort of are, you know, in specific spots on the political spectrum. And here, and there's also a very clear type of electorate that is associated with these parties, whilst in Georgia, it's all a bit blurred, and it's way more, as Grigol underlined, about emotions. It's not even necessarily about specific policies or specific platform. It's all about this dynamic, the government versus the opposition. And there might be some issues that come up all of a sudden that become super emotional, that were sort of not part of the picture before, and it can sort of overhaul the whole political scene. So in terms of this European, let's say, integration, we can't, for example, say that for sure everybody who votes for the Georgian Dream is anti-European or Eurosceptic. And also, you know, you have to take that into account. There might be some of those people who also go to these pro-EU protests. It's probably not the majority of the Georgian Dream voters, but there might be some. So I think there's a lot of nuance there. And maybe Georgia in that sense doesn't fit into these strict categories of how the political parties work and how the electorates are sort of associated with these parties. So that was incredibly interesting for me. And what was also really important, I think, and Grigo as an expert in terms of Russian propaganda and Russian disinformation also underlined it several times, that what is happening now in Georgia is quite dangerous in a sense that Russia will be gaining more and more influence in the information sphere and the media sphere. And so this is something that definitely should be paid attention to. And the EU also needs to keep that in mind, because if it keeps Georgia at arm's length, or even if it distances itself from Georgia, this will give more space to Russia to spread its disinformation and to influence the Georgian population. So that is something very important that I think we should all keep in mind.
Yeah, I totally agree. Those are important things to discuss, to be aware of. We tried from time to time to cover also this disinformation aspect and Russia's engineered disinformation campaigns in the region. So for sure, we'll come back to it. And fortunately, we like to invite the same guests again to Talk Eastern Europe. So I hope Grigol will accept our next invitation, so you will have a chance to ask him one of those questions that appeared on your list during this interview. Thank you again very much. Before we go off, we want to remind you that Talk Eastern Europe is proudly supported by our community. And if you like our podcast, please join us as a patron. Depending on the membership level, you can get special benefits such as access to our closed Facebook group, where you can ask us questions and just stay in touch with us. Other membership levels contain extra content available only for patrons, free online access to the New Eastern Europe magazine, and a free print edition of the current issue of the magazine. And prices range from just $2 up to $15 per month. And if you are not sure yet, or you want to continue listening to the podcast without such a commitment, please consider supporting us by recommending the podcast to others. It helps us to broaden our network and develop this project. If you have any idea how we can improve our program, send us your feedback. Last but not least, please visit our website www.talkeasterneurope.eu, where you can find the entire archive of our program. You can also reach out to all three co-hosts of the podcast on Twitter and other social media.
Yes, absolutely. Please interact with us. We've been receiving some comments from different listeners, patrons recently, and we value them a lot. You give us some really great ideas and some really great observations. So please feel free to interact with us. We are nice people. We like talking to our listeners. So don't hesitate.
And the last but the most important part of each episode is our traditional patron shout out. Agnieszka, do you want to take this privilege this time?
With pleasure, with pleasure. So I would like to take this opportunity to say the biggest thank you to our patrons who are supporting us and without whom we wouldn't be able to do what we're doing. And so I would like to just say thank you, and hello to Susie, David, Daniel, Carolina, Percy, RSJ, Michael, Anais, Tom, Olaf, CB, Klaus, Plamen, Sean, Naomi, JP, Elise, Sean, David, Urs, Ian, Sophia, Wilhelm, David, Erica, Janosz, Jason, Mark, Stephanie, and Pierre. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. That's all what we have for you today. Thanks for tuning in, and until next time.
Talk to you soon.